The cinema specialists are back, and we have never looked better than we look right now. My goodness gracious, look at us. We have a new logo. We have a background here for StreamYard rather than just talking to you all with a black background as our screen. And we had a thumbnail tonight, and the thumbnails are going to become the norm, which is super exciting. I'm very happy with the way that this looks. As any of you who follow the channel as a whole know, the rebrand is official. Everything has changed. We have new logos across the board. And this is the exciting stuff that's coming. I mean, this is for our second tier podcast, third tier podcast, whatever you want to call it. And it looks so good. Austin Garceau made the backgrounds here. And I'm really happy with how they look. And the logos all came from Casa de Dope, which they've been really well received with the exception of one person. But that was okay. Because, yeah, there was just one person, John, who just didn't like it. You can't please everybody, though. Raptor8415 said it was a cool thumbnail. Camden Ewan, who is a new patron, said, sick, looks great. So here we are. We're back, and we're talking Avengers Endgame and Yorgos Lanthimos' Poor Things. So those are our two episodes for tonight, our two movies for tonight. John, how you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, we're in that post-holiday wind down, but still like that weird week we get at the end of December, which just means watching a lot of movies, and it's a good time of the year.
Yeah, there's a lot of movies out right now that that need to be watched or are being watched or whatever you want to say. I mean, it's a crowded time at the movie theater, which was nice because when I went and saw Poor Things, as anybody who's been following this podcast since the early days knows, sometimes it's really hard to get a good movie going experience when you live in South Florida. And I will say, the crowd at Poor Things, that was a packed theater. It was actually an enjoyable experience. I don't know what to do with myself. Yeah, people weren't talking. The opening of that movie is very quiet and everybody remained quiet. It was just an unusual experience and I'm glad I had it. So yeah, I guess people are taking it more seriously. I was looking like what movie we're going to do next week and we've talked about it a little bit. But man, my theater is showing movies at 9:20 in the morning tomorrow. Like what in the world?
What?
I don't know.
What a time to be alive. Gotta love it. Telling
you. So yeah, but what ended up winning the box? So Aquaman did win the box office this week. I mean, it didn't have a very good weekend, but it did end up winning the box office with 27 million. And then second place was Wonka, which we talked about last week. Third was Migration. Fourth was Anyone But You, which made only $6 million. I don't know what the budget on that was, but I assume that's not good. So yeah, we have our options for next week. We'll be talking about it, but we're starting off with Poor Things. That's the first one we're doing. If you want to do Avengers Endgame, like I always say, skip to about 30 minutes. Poor Things is probably going to take the full half hour tonight because this is a weird movie. And I'll preface it with this. This is going to be an R-rated conversation. Okay? So you have been warned. There's no way to talk about this movie without it being an R-rated conversation. So we try to keep this family friendly. We try not to curse. We try not to do much of that stuff. John does like to say penis every now and then on this podcast, which makes my American ass very uncomfortable, but everybody else likes it. So we're talking Poor Things. And this is the type of movie that always makes me laugh when I look back at 2010 when Blue Valentine was rated NC-17.
Yeah.
And then this is a movie that comes out and it's rated, you know, a soft R. They're not even considering it to be NC-17. There's no conversation about it being NC-17 from what I remember reading. I mean, I've been following this movie since it first got announced. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are gratuitous sex scenes in this movie, and it is so much more than anything that was in Blue Valentine's. It's just funny kind of how the landscape has changed, but this is such a weird movie. And I could sit here and I could talk about it for 30 minutes and tell you every plot point, and I still don't feel like I'm spoiling it because it really is, as with Yorgos Lanthimos all the time, it is one of those movies that kind of needs to be seen to be understood, and still it's not necessarily entirely understood on one viewing, but it has its fun twists and turns. It's very stylized. It's definitely style over substance in a lot of ways, but we're going to have some powerhouse performances nominated for Oscars. If they don't give him the makeup Oscar for production design on this one, after screwing him out of The Favorite so Black Panther could win, my goodness gracious, because the production design on this movie was absolutely absurd. But John, you gave it 3 stars. I gave it 3.5. I do think that it's perhaps a bit overrated. However, Yorgos may have hit a certain level that we'll talk about later on. So what's your feeling overall on this movie?
Like you said, I think it's a bit of an overrated movie. And I think we've hit a point in Yorgos Lanthimos' career where he's becoming a household name. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of weird for someone who makes very strange movies like Yorgos does. Obviously, we've talked about The Lobster on this podcast when we were doing our top 100 because it's on my top 100. We've mentioned The Favorite several times on this podcast. We haven't actually talked about it, but we both think very highly of that movie. I personally love The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And, I mean, Dogtooth is also, you know, another great film. So I went in with really high expectations for this one. And maybe they were too high. Maybe a lot of it also had to do with the award buzz the movie's getting. Mm-hmm. This just left me wanting more, though. Like, I wanted something more out of this movie. There were some great moments where it's really investigating the human condition and it's really investigating what it truly means to be human and to be a free human. But, like you said, it's so stylized. It's so overly stylized in a fantastic, like, steampunkish type of way. Mm-hmm. It just feels like there's too much focus on that when there could have been more focus on the deeper themes of the film.
Yeah, I feel like the themes are hit on, but I do feel like Yorgos leaned in so hard to his style. So, like, Dogtooth is my favorite Yorgos Lanthimos or Lanthimos. I have no idea, but it's my favorite. I just call him Yorgos because I at least think I got that right. But it's my favorite of his movies. I love the look at that of, like, you know, the allegory for the Greek government and how it's abusing their citizens and things like that, and setting it in a family that is isolated and the parents are abusing the children and lying to them and making them live in this fantasy world that they don't understand. That they lick my piano. I say it all the time. Lick my piano is one of my favorite lines in the history of film. It is so unbelievably well done to set up your own joke and have it, you know, land like it does in that movie. And I felt like with this one, he was definitely leaning in hard to the old school film. Like he was going hard for his history, right? Like every time, once they leave the house, once she goes out into the world, this is straight out of Malaise, right? George Malaise, his trip to the moon. I mean, it is straight out of A Trip to the Moon, where the boat is so weird looking, the little cable cars, it looks like it's just very uneven, very old school. It almost looks paper mache for parts of this. And I mean, Alexandria, when they get to Alexandria, you're like, what am I looking at? It's so bizarre. But then even when they're in the house, he's leaning in really hard to the old school Universal horror movies and things like that, where it's very unsettling. And everything's very uneven. Her riding the bicycle or tricycle is very creepy. And he leans in really hard to that. And I saw it with my wife. And at the end of the movie, my wife said, I just wish that it was more than just about the sex for Emma Stone, because it seemed like that was the whole point of, like, how she is going to be a feminist, like how she is going to rise above the male gaze and the male everything was just going to be sex, 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 sex. And I understand why Yorgos did it this way. And also, when you watch Yorgos' entire cinematography, that is primarily what he is using as the focal point of his movies. I mean, you see, I mean, The Favorite is insane. Dogtooth is very much, you know, the whole point of Dogtooth is sex, and you know, it's like a lot of it's an allegory for rape and things like that. But still, when you watch these movies, you know that that's where it's going to go. I was shocked by how far he went with a lot of the sex and things like that, and didn't go as far with some of the other development of Emma Stone's Bella Baxter.
Yeah, I understand using sex as a tool. And it's really interesting that this movie is coming out. I'm really interested to see, like, Gen Z's response to this movie as a generation that has really talked about the fact that they don't want sex in movies as much. They don't think it's necessary in movies. And when Yorgos takes it and really ingrains it into the core of this film, where a lot of Bella's learning about the world comes through sexual exploration and sex, and just sex in general, it makes it very interesting to see how different generations are going to react to this movie. I was talking about going to see this movie with my mother yesterday, and I am so glad I did not.
Yeah, this is not a go see it with your parents movie. Although I was sitting next to an older couple who had to be in their 60s or 70s, and they were loving every second of this movie. They were laughing their asses off. But it is interesting because audiences change. You have to think back in the 40s, if you saw the shoulder, you couldn't believe it. I mean, in Double Indemnity, when Barbara Stanwyck is walking down the stairs, you can't believe it. But he made an erotic thriller. You know, it's not really a thriller, but he made an erotic film, which we don't see get made as often nowadays as it used to. And now when they do, a lot of times it's just for gratuitous for the sake of being gratuitous. It's not really, you know, it's not really as purposeful as it felt when Stanley Kubrick was doing it for Eyes Wide Shut, or when it was being done for Basic Instinct or something along those lines. Sometimes it just feels like it's excessive for the sake of being excessive. But this movie, it was definitely excessive, but I felt like I understood what the point was the entire time. But that being said, that doesn't necessarily mean that audiences are going to cling to it and love it in the way that they might have liked this if this movie had come out 10 years ago. I still am shocked, though, that this is a movie that is up there and being discussed for Best Picture and things like that. Not because I don't think it deserves it. This is just such a weird movie. I mean, this is one of the weirdest movies that would win Best Picture. This is probably the weirdest movie to win Best Picture if it ends up winning Best Picture. It won't win. I don't think it has any chance.
I don't think so either.
But it would be bizarre.
Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting seeing how many people are clinging on to this movie and really enjoying it. Because personally, I kind of think it's Yorgos' worst film, which is saying something. I know. I enjoyed this movie quite a lot, but I don't know, it didn't hit me the way that something like even like The Killing of the Sacred Deer hit me. And I found myself almost tired of how many sex scenes there were in this movie. Like, it got to a point towards the end of the film where I was like, oh, we're gonna watch another sex scene.
That's kind of, it makes me wonder. They say we're prude, so that's coming from a Canadian.
Yeah, exactly. Like, again, I don't know if this movie was rated R up here. I must have been, but like, they're pretty lenient with the gratings up here.
When it comes to sex, had to be
violence puts you over the top, but sex.
There was a lot of violence in this movie too, though.
There was a lot of violence in this movie.
And you know, I mean, especially I did like towards the end, you know, what I did appreciate about this movie is when it started getting into who she was as a person prior to becoming Bella Baxter. And this is established right away, so I won't get into the details of the ending, although I thought the ending was absolutely brilliant, and I do want to talk about that, so I'll put a heavy spoiler warning on that when we get to that point. However, when you watch this movie, she, you know, the first scene is somebody jumping off a bridge, and you know it's going to be Emma Stone. And so what you learn is, you know, the process of how she was turned into Bella Baxter. And I really liked when this movie started to get into who she was before she jumped off the bridge, and and, you know, the people who start recognizing her and her ex-husband and things like that. And that's where the violence kind of starts to come in, right? Because now she's, you know, you see the way her ex-husband is acting, you see the way she's acting. You know, it's not even so much violence, it's more of just the we're going to cut you up and carve you open, and we're going to leave the body on the bed with the whole chest cavity ripped open. And can you figure out where the liver goes? And do you know where this goes? And it's very fun. And it's so stylized again, that it's not necessarily violence, but when she is stabbing the eyeballs going squishy, squishy, squishy. I mean, it's so ridiculous. But it had to have been R. I would be shocked if this was not.
I imagine so. I just don't pay attention to ratings now that I'm, you know, over the age of 18.
That's true. That's a good point. That's a good point. You know, it's not that big of a deal. But yeah, this was definitely more than I thought it was going to be. And from a style standpoint, from an acting standpoint, from, you know, the themes of this movie, all that, it was a lot more than I thought it was going to be. I mean, the fact that, you know, we have her going and working in a brothel for the longest time and like all of that that goes on in there. But really, like you said, it gets a little tiring that you're like, okay, here's another sex scene. But you are seeing the growth of her character through all of that, which is impressive because a lot of times you don't necessarily see that. So that is one thing that does need to be commended, because he is managing to make it so that it is like, it is developing everybody. And I have to say, Emma Stone is insane in this movie. I mean, her performance in this movie, Lily Gladstone's amazing, so it's going to come down to the two of them, and it's going to be tight because Lily Gladstone is incredible in Killers of the Flower Moon. But it always comes down to the age-old question at the Oscars of, do they want subtle or do they want over the top? And Emma Stone's over the top performance in this movie is one of the all times. I mean, she is so incredible in this movie. And the way she plays, she's so dead. She's a sociopath. Yeah. She has no idea because she's not a real person. Like she's a zombie, essentially. The way she plays that role and plays it so matter-of-factly, the way she walks, the way her facial expressions are, all of that. It's incredible. It's incredible. And that is how I think I ultimately gave this 3.5 stars. I ultimately gave it 3.5 stars because of how good Emma Stone is. And Mark Ruffalo as well. We'll talk about Mark Ruffalo. But yeah. Emma Stone, to me, just like, she nailed this. And maybe she just gets Yorgos because she was great in The Favorite, too. And in my opinion, should have won the Oscar that year.
Yeah, I can't deny how fantastic Emma Stone is in this. And the progression that she takes this character from this essentially like a babbling baby at the beginning of the film to this incredibly well-spoken, strong woman at the end of the film is fascinating. And just, you have to watch her physical performance as this film goes on, because there are subtle changes from scene to scene, but each one is so powerful when you consider what it's actually saying about her development as a person.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. Like, Emma Stone, for me too, raised this movie 0.5 star.
Yeah. Yeah. She
got it to a 3 for me.
Yeah, she really is just, she's just on a different level. Who beat her? Oh, Regina King. Yeah, and I always say Regina King and If Beale Street Could Talk, they didn't even nominate the right person. I thought she was just non-existent in that movie. But she really, really captures it. And I mean, the face that she's making in the poster of this movie, like, that's how she acts the entire time. Her face is devoid of life. And, you know, you watch her as all these people around her are feeling human emotions, and she's feeling nothing. Over and over. But what does she feel as she gets older? She feels the confidence. She feels the control. She feels those sorts of emotions. And they really come across in this movie. I mean, it comes across phenomenally well. By the end of this movie, she's sitting there and she's reading that book, and you're like, man, like, I can't believe the journey that we just watched this character go on. You might not agree with every step along the way or every decision Yorgos made, but the journey that Bella Baxter goes on from what we see at the beginning to what we see at the end is really remarkable. And it's fun because as you start to think about her decisions and her reasoning behind some of the things she's doing in this movie, you try to make sense of it, but then you realize it only makes sense because of who your main character is. And, you know, that's the power of a good screenplay, and that's the power of a great performance.
It's a great understanding of this idea of the accelerated growth leading to a more analytical approach to life. And I think it's really what Yorgos is going for. Obviously, I mean, it's impossible to say that this is not taking a lot from Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, and thematically especially. And when you look at the comparison between the monster and Bella, it's very clear, like, this idea of accelerated growth in the mind results in a more analytical approach to the world. And as you grow up, and if we take too much time growing up, we get too caught in emotion, which we see, I think, really shown in all the male characters in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, because we see that especially from Mark Ruffalo and the doctor, whose name I can't remember, not Willem Dafoe, the younger McCandless.
Yeah.
You know, you really see that from his character. But I mean, going to the Frankenstein thing, I mean, Willem Dafoe literally looks like the Frankenstein monster in this movie. You know,
yes, he's
playing the Frankenstein monster in this movie. He just happens to be the one who's creating the monster rather than being the monster. But, you know, and the setup, and here's my spoiler. So I'm going to do this. It's 19:02 on the clock now. If you're listening, don't tune back in. If you don't want to know this, don't tune back in until 20:30. And John, you're not allowed to respond with a spoiler. But at the end of this movie, there you go. There's your spoiler. You got a minute and 15 seconds. At the end of this movie, when you find out that Willem Dafoe is dying and you see that he's a good man and he's always been ashamed that he's never been good looking, so everybody's always scared of him and blah, blah, blah. And then you have her husband who is good looking but evil. And it's like, oh, she looks up how to do the brain surgery. She's going to make it work. She's going to make this happen. And then what ends up happening is you get that scene where she's in the hospital room with him. And then the doctor comes in and you're like, okay, they're going to give him the brain when the guy dies. And then she does it with the goat instead. I mean, that is just brilliant filmmaking and subversion of expectations and just it really puts the final finishing touch on what this movie is about, which is it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter. She has grown into this independent, you know, fierce woman, whatever word you want to use. And she does not feel emotion just because she went through this stuff. She does not feel that emotion as strongly as other people do. So she keeps her sociopathic tendencies. And when that guy is eating the grass at the end of the movie, I was dying because that's pure Yorgos Lanthimos. And there you go. I did it within 20-30. So now 2-1, spoilers over. John, hi.
Now I can't even respond to it though.
Well, I guess you can respond, but you can't. You just got to be like, yeah, that was good.
It was good. I really enjoy how Yorgos approaches it. Again, it feels very similar to his other films with the way he's approaching this finale. And it feels like a good payoff. It feels like the correct way to end the film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I do. I do agree. I concur. And, you know, it stays dark. And it has to stay dark. Because this movie, you can't have a gothic nightmare movie end on a happy note. It's just not allowed. No. It's literally not allowed. So, yeah, I'm glad he ended it on the note that he did, because it's not allowed. So, Mark Ruffalo. So we might have the best supporting actor category we've had in a decade right now. You know, I throw these words out there randomly, but right now we have Robert De Niro for Killers of the Flower Moon. We have Mark Ruffalo for this. We have Robert Downey Jr. for Oppenheimer. And we have, who am I missing? I'm missing Ryan Gosling for Barbie. Who is, like, Mark Ruffalo is incredible in this. And he does an accent, which I've never heard Mark Ruffalo do an accent before.
I don't think I have either. Other than the really terrible accent he does in Spotlight. But that's a different type of accent.
Yeah, I mean, and he almost won for that. But that's a really bad movie, and he still sounds like Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah, I mean, that's not even mentioning some of the other possible nominations for that category as well.
Like, who are the other possibles? Because I'm drawing a blank. I'm just looking at last year's, like, Barry Keoghan, however you say his last name. He was great. And you have Ke-Huy Quan win. You have Brendan Gleeson, who's great. But then Brian Tyree Henry was pretty much in a movie nobody saw. And Judd Hirsch is in one scene in The Fabelmans. Those are your five nominees. It's not even close right now. It's not even close.
No. I don't even know who else is, like, in the rumor mill right now for this.
Let me see. Best supporting actor predictions. But talk about Mark Ruffalo while I look this up.
But Mark Ruffalo, I think it's fascinating that we get to talk about two Mark Ruffalo performances in this podcast, because they are so different from one another. And what Mark Ruffalo does, he comes in as this incredibly, like, suave, confident, debonair type character. And we see how pathetic he is as the movie goes on. And you're kind of led to believe that just immediately based on how you meet him. But to see how pathetic he gets towards the end of this film, it's just on another level. And Mark Ruffalo presents it in such a fascinating way, where, as someone who doesn't even understand what Bella is, responds to it in this way where it's like, what the heck are you doing? He responds to it in a logical way as any human would respond to a human in that situation. And as it becomes more and more clear that Bella is gaining power over him, he just becomes this sniveling mess by the end of the film.
Oh my God. When he tries to throw Martha off the boat, that part just absolutely killed me. Her Harry or whatever was like, yeah, go ahead. She does look like she's ready to be thrown off the boat. And he goes to try to throw her off the boat. I mean, that part was just so good. And yeah, this was the most impressed I've ever been with Ruffalo. I thought he was phenomenal because I'm a huge Willem Dafoe fan. Willem Dafoe's in the conversation. I don't think he'll ultimately get the nomination because he doesn't do anything over the top. But I really do love Willem Dafoe, and I went into this expecting to be on Team Willem Dafoe for who should get the nomination.
Yeah.
And when Ruffalo started speaking, my jaw kind of dropped because it's so unlike him. And he does play such a suave yet sniveling. Those are really good words to use to describe him. The other person who got nominated for the Globe was Charles Melton for May, December, which is the Todd Haynes movie on Netflix. And then
he was pretty good in that.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. Maybe that's a movie we should do for this because I think that's getting some buzz. But you have him and then Sterling K. Brown for American Fiction, Dominic Sessa for The Holdovers, Defoe, Jesse Plemons for Killers of the Flower Moon. I mean, you're pretty much running. It goes away.
You're quickly. Running the same people at that point, yeah.
Yeah, it goes away quickly. But Gosling, Downey Jr., De Niro, Ruffalo, man, I would not be mad if any of them won. I think I, you know, because I know you didn't love Oppenheimer, but Downey Jr. gives a really good performance in that. And Downey Jr.'s, you know, he's definitely good enough that if he beat any of those people, I wouldn't sit here going, well, I'm insulted. You know, it wouldn't be, yep. It wouldn't be how I felt when Regina King beat everybody from The Favour, because Regina King wasn't even the right person to nominate for that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think just like off the top of my head, I feel like I prefer De Niro's performance, but like Mark Ruffalo, the interesting thing about Mark Ruffalo is he really brings out his comedic chops in this movie. And this movie is just, it's a comedy. There's no other way to like explain this movie. It's this gothic horror comedy blend. But it's really hard to have those beats. And we've seen Mark Ruffalo through our MCU watch have comedic beats that just don't land. So yeah. To see him perform this strongly in this, it reminds me more of the Mark Ruffalo we got in Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah. Yeah, he's going back to being a serious actor, right? And I think a lot of the people who were in these Marvel movies, they made a whole bunch of money for just, you didn't have to be that good of an actor. And I'm not saying these are bad actors. I think everybody who's in these movies is talented. I mean, we've seen them across the board, whether you're Anthony Mackie or you're Scarlett Johansson, you're in Oscar winning, Oscar nominated, you're getting Oscar nominated. Like these people are getting it all across the board. But it becomes very easy to say, I'm going to talk with my normal voice and grumble every now and then. And that's really all there needs to be. And now we finally see what can happen, though, when you do dive back into a meaty role like Mark Ruffalo just did. And he did something with it. There was some he used his charisma and he did something with it. And yeah, I was impressed. I mean, I would say right now I still want Gosling to win. I think Gosling for Barbie is the best performance of the year. I think he's very funny. And it's hard with comedic performances sometimes. But he reminds me of Kevin Kline in A Fish Called Wanda, where without him, that movie's not comedic enough, and it needs his role and it needs his stupid airhead, whatever. I mean, Kevin Kline in A Fish Called Wanda is great. So yeah, I'd still go Gosling, but Ruffalo was great. And between Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone, good luck, Oscar.
Awesome at this point, yeah.
Yeah. Good luck. I mean, I just know that the best actress winner will have Stone in their last name. That is all I am certain of by the end of this year. And Oscar nominations come out January 23rd. So we'll see. I mean, we still got a little bit of time until then, but that's when they're coming out. And at this point, I don't think we're in for any more surprises. It doesn't seem like there's going to be any movies that come out between now and, you know, the end of the year or any performances that are going to sneak up on us and all of a sudden get a nomination, kind of like the Brian Tyree Henry performance last year that, you know, came out of nowhere with Causeway. But I think that's also because we're at the point where movies are coming out again. We're getting our full slate of movies now in 2023, which we hadn't been getting. And so we're finally at that point where it's as crowded as it was back in 2019. And 2019 was an insanely competitive year. So, yeah, that's where we're at. Give us your finishing touches, John, on Poor Things, because then I'm going to go into
it. Finishing touches on Poor Things. I thoroughly enjoyed the ship segment. This film's broken up into, I guess, five parts, technically. And I really enjoyed the ship segment, or I guess it's six parts, actually. The ship segment, which is the third segment, and then the London segment was very good. And I enjoyed the first segment, but it didn't quite get rolling until we got to Lisbon, I found. Which is where like the film really got an identity, which is funny, because that's also where the film becomes color. And this is now the third movie I have watched this year that is in talk for like Oscar contention. That does this split black, white color thing.
It made so much sense in this though, because it's going from like her in the house, not seeing the world, being a baby, all of that. And then becoming, you know, like coming to terms with it. It's kind of like in Room, where the color saturation in Room, when the blanket flies off Jacob Tremblay's head, is insane.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it does make sense because it's Bella experiencing the world and finally understanding the world, which makes it so it's not so black and white. And also the character isn't black and white anymore, because she gains experience. It makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. 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 Well, we're going to be, for anybody who's, you know, going to become a patron, we have it at the bottom here, become a patron at patreon.com/thespecialist. Now it's in front of your face if you're watching on YouTube all the time. So that's nice. But, we'll be talking about the Oscar nominees for Best Picture once the Oscar nominees come out over on Patreon for our $10 tier. It's all listed there. And we'll go through every Best Picture nominee. We'll give each one its own dedicated episode talking about the chances to win and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that'll be coming January 23rd and we'll get more into Poor Things. And because I'm assuming at this point, I'd be shocked if it didn't get nominated.
I'd be shocked, yeah.
And in addition to that, if you want to get in at our lowest level with Patreon, John and I are going to be doing an extra podcast every week over there. It's going to start off, it's called $5 Tuesday. So we'll release every Tuesday and it's going to start off with movies that are hitting big anniversaries. That's not what it's always going to be. We've kind of talked about what our life is going to be like on YouTube after the Marvel rewatch is done. And then what we're going to actually, you know, move over to the Patreon. But for now we are going to be doing movies with big anniversaries. And the first one we're going to do is the 20th anniversary of Mean Girls. So we're going to be talking about Mean Girls, but that'll also be released as our Patreon preview on YouTube. So if you want to see what that's all about first, you have time to do that because that's, you know, it's going to be released here on YouTube. So you can see that and then determine what else you want to do. So we're also going to be doing, you know, there's just pretty much look at anything that's 25, 30, 45, anything that ends with a five or a zero. It'll give you an idea of what we're looking at. And go look at movies that John or I are rewatching that we might not necessarily like, because that will tell you what we're probably doing for this podcast, as I saw with one of John's reviews today. So let's jump over to Avengers Endgame. Yeah. Let's jump over to Avengers Endgame and let's talk about this 3-hour and 2-minute monstrosity. This is a large movie and we're coming off of Captain Marvel, which I firmly believe is the worst Marvel movie up to this point, and I don't think it's particularly close after watching, you know, everything else. So this one, my expectations were low. I thoroughly enjoyed the first hour. And then they started talking about time travel, and they set out all these rules for time travel and how it would work and blah, blah, blah. And then the movie for the next 45 minutes proceeded to break every single one of those rules without giving us a legitimate reason why it was breaking those rules. And that made me really mad. And then that dropped it down to a 2-star movie. But I'm going to be honest, that first hour, I'm sitting there going, I like this. They're taking their time with each character. We're not just jumping around. I always said Infinity War felt like a 2.5-hour trailer. It was taking its time. We were getting to know them. It felt like it was setting scenes up like a real movie. And then it got into this time travel thing. And I said, okay, I'm in. And then they were just like, okay, go with it now because we're just going to go completely over the top with this. And I said, whatever. I guess I don't have a choice. So, yeah. Sure. Here we are. John, you gave it 1.5.
I did. I really don't like this movie. And like you said, the first hour is the best part of this movie. And that's because it's just the leftovers.
It is.
And then it gets, yeah, it's the leftovers. It's the most compelling part. I was sitting there and you watch the first bit where we have Hawkeye with his family and then his family disappears. And you're like, this is the movie I want to be watching right now. I want to see how he responds to this. And I'm thinking about the leftover. I found myself thinking about the leftovers a lot recently and seeing this, it's like, wow, man, they should have just, you know, got Damon Lindelof to do this. Cause this would have been much better if they did.
Yeah.
And just investigating that bit of the story would have been interesting. And I think what really takes this movie down is the fact that we didn't get that movie in between Infinity War and this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you kind of waste your time with Captain Marvel and Ant-Man and the Wasp, even though I enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp. Like, you do kind of waste your time with those two movies. Mm-hmm. And then it comes into this one and you're like, okay, let's get into this. And it feels like it wants to, but then it only touches on it for an hour because then it has to get into the action and whatever and the crazy cinematic stuff you expect from a Marvel movie. Also, and I understand he comes back later in the movie, but the killing of Thanos is so weak in the first 40 minutes of this movie or whenever it happens. I think it's 25 minutes in. It is so weak because the buildup is too big. So even though he does come back because they're, you know, doing everything that they're doing, it needed to have a little bit more to it. I feel, in my opinion, I felt like it was just a little whatever. And it shouldn't feel like a throwaway, even if it's not the main time that he's going to die. It should still carry a little bit more impact because you do think when you're watching this first time that it is the main time he's going to die. So that was a big one for me.
Yeah, I've watching the movie this time around, I came to the conclusion that everything we kind of praise Infinity War for doing to Thanos, this movie just erases.
Yeah.
Multiple times over. Because it gives us the weird cut. I have so many thoughts, and I know I'm a little scattered right now. Mm-hmm. Why do we get the title card prior to Thanos dying if it happens so early in the movie?
I know. It almost feels like whatever James Bond that is, where they killed what's his name? God, I can't think of his name. John, what's the one? It's Diamonds Are Forever. Right?
Do you mean when they kill Blofeld?
Yeah, it's Diamonds Are Forever, right?
No. That was one of the Roger Moore ones that happens in.
Okay, whatever it is, he just kills him right off the bat. And then it gets into the opening credits. And that's like how this felt like it should be, because they do the title thing and then they go kill Thanos like 10 minutes later. And you're sitting there saying to yourself, what's going on? What's happening?
And then they give you a time skip.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, why is this not where the title card's coming in?
Mm-hmm. And why do they do 5 years later? And I know that like that's a nitpick, but I'm seriously wondering, why do you think they made the decision to do it that way instead of just saying 5 years later all is one thing? Why do they do 5 years later?
I don't know, because I can't actually think of a reason to do that. Because once you put the word 5 there, so like once you put a title card and you have a number there, I mean, we can run through every possible iteration of what time we are using to measure it then afterwards. But why? Like, why are we spending... This is like you said, this is a 3-hour and 2-minute movie. Why are we spending a minute of it on a title card?
Yeah, I don't know. It was a weird decision to not just put it all at once. And I was like, were they trying to make us think it was going to be 5 years earlier, 5 days later, 5 days early? I didn't know if that carried some significance in the comic books that I just wasn't privy to, because I've never read the comics.
Nope.
Okay. That's good to know. Things I liked, always going to like Captain America, never going to complain about Captain America. Don't like the decision they made with Captain America at the end of this movie, but we'll get to that. I like Paul Rudd as Ant-Man. I think that still works in this movie. And I think him coming back 5 years later and wondering what the heck is going on really does work. I think that giving a family to Iron Man was a nice little moment and something to do.
Yep.
But that's really kind of the extent of it outside of that first hour of the movie. Like once they get into the time travel, I found myself feeling like, okay, this is just nonsense now. Like they're not, they're jumping around, they're going to these different areas, and it almost feels like they're saying to people, look, isn't this cool? This is what was happening behind the scenes or off to the side while you were watching the movie. And that's great and all, but it felt like, okay, what rules are established? What rules aren't happening? What is going on right now that should be make sense? And I don't know. I gave up on trying to think about the logic of it all. I gave up on trying to figure that out, and maybe that's kind of what they wanted me to do. Maybe they're saying just turn your brain off and watch the movie and shut up, but I don't know, like to establish it like they did and talk about it and then just throw it off to the wayside. I don't know. It felt lazy to me. And then by the time you do get to the end where all of a sudden you start to realize, oh, they brought these people back and they did this, and you have the god awful all women going to go fight Thanos' people one shot, which is just so pathetic. Oh my God, that scene is so bad. And this is where I'm so happy I watch it at home, because I was watching that in a theater and people cheered for that. I would be like, you're stupid and you're stupid and you're stupid. I wouldn't be able to help myself, you know, but like you have that and it all kind of just feels meaningless by that point, because a part of me says, wait, how did they get here? You know what I mean? And I think that was my frustration with this. I still enjoyed, out of all the Avengers movies, this is my favorite one. That's not saying much. I gave it 2 stars, but this is my favorite of the Avengers movies. But by the time I got to the ending, I said, wait, how did we get here? How did Thanos get duped? Why wasn't Thanos able to see that this was going to happen? Especially when he ends, you know, he says, oh, well, that's destiny confirmed or something, when he ends up getting killed by his daughter. Like, I don't understand how he didn't know that all this was going to happen or why it was going to happen, or still even how they pulled it all off and this was able to bring every single person back so perfectly. I don't know. It just felt like a big reach for me. And then I swear you're going to talk right after this. And then the biggest thing for me was at the end, I felt like every decision they made with a big character was the wrong one. And I understand Robert Downey Jr. didn't want to do these movies anymore. I understand you got to kind of move on from the old guard and you got to get past like Chris Evans and those characters. But I felt like every decision that was made, whether it be that Chris Evans is passing his shield off to Falcon, or that, you know, Robert Downey Jr. just dies or anything like that. It's like, okay, you were going to continue though. And Jason Obermeyer says here, for many, this really is the end of the MCU. It feels like the end of the MCU, which if this was the end, I'd probably give this a better rating. But it's the fact that now this is going to continue. And I say to myself, why? Like, how? Why is there going to be more beyond this? Because that would be a nice send-off if it was just Chris Evans being old and saying, I'm done. It's now your turn. But knowing that then there's going to be a TV show and then he is the Captain America. And you're just like, no, that's no good. That's just terrible decision-making.
Well, okay. I mean, that one in particular does actually happen in the comics. Not like Chris Evans, like not Captain America going to the past and then aging out and deciding to give his power. But like Sam Wilson does become Captain America in the comics. That is a thing that happens. But I'm okay with Tony Stark's death. I think it actually closes his character arc that they've been building over these, what, 8 movies he's been in. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with that. I agree. I don't like the Cap conclusion. I really didn't like it this time. A lot of that has to do with the breaking of time travel rules, though.
Yeah.
And all these other characters, like you said, this works well as a conclusion, but it's not even the conclusion of Phase 3.
Yeah.
There's another movie after this that concludes Phase 3 for some reason. Mm-hmm. And
it felt weird because I started thinking, is Spider-Man even going to be in this movie? And then when he was, I said, wait, why is there another movie in this phase?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't really make sense. And I think this is where we really start to see, and we kind of talked about it before with the transition between Phase 2 and Phase 3. But I think we're at a point where it's very clear Disney doesn't know what they're doing at this point. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't know what they're doing to make this continual. I think the MCU grew to a point where it was so big that even Disney didn't know how to handle it anymore.
Yeah. I think that's fair.
Yeah. And it's very clear when you have this 3-hour movie to conclude your saga you started with Captain America, the first Avenger. Like, arguably you started it with Iron Man, but technically the introduction of the Infinity Stones happens in the first Avenger. And has gone on since that to now. Mm-hmm. So we've built it up. It was 10 years in the making. And we get to this point, it should feel satisfying. And it just doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and you know, something else that really bothered me in this, and I think Chadwick Boseman was, you know, he obviously was battling cancer by this point, but does he even talk in this movie?
He has 2 lines, I believe.
Does he? Okay, because he barely talks. Like, it felt like they just threw everybody in as much as they could. And I know, like, that last shot where they're all at the funeral, that makes sense. If that's the end of it, that's fine. That's a good ending. That's solid. Mm-hmm. But I have to look at this movie as what it is as a whole and how it's going to continue. And I found myself going, well, I don't really care. I don't know why it's going to continue. And Jason Obermeyer again says, crumbling under its own weight, you eventually reach a peak. It did. It reached its peak. Yeah. And, you know, this is where they start making it so that the TV shows must be viewed in order for you to understand the movies and mm-hmm. things along those lines. And that's just asking too much of an audience, because especially in today's day and age, most people are working more than 40 hours in a week. A lot of people are working 2 jobs, things like that. If you have the ability to keep up with all of this stuff, you had a really good week, or you have, you know, you got sick, or you had something, or you're so into it that you're not going to miss it. It's a lot to try to stay on top of, almost to the point where it's impossible to stay on top of. And like somebody like me, I'm sitting here and we're going to do a Traders podcast in January. And I'm trying to figure out how am I going to fit the entire season one of the Traders in the next 2 weeks, just so that I can start season two of the Traders and have an understanding of what the show was. And like, they're asking you, okay, now go watch this show. Now go watch this show. Now go watch WandaVision. Now go watch this. And it's like, that's a lot, especially when this does feel like a conclusion. And what's even crazier is what it was less than 2 months later that Spider-Man Far From Home comes out. It wasn't even a full 2 months. I think it was a month and a week between Avengers Endgame and this. I think it was April 26th and then July 2nd. So actually it was 2 months and a week. Sorry. But that's no time at all. I mean, so you don't even let this one settle. You don't even let this one settle. And then you're already jumping into another movie. And that just feels like the wrong decision. But at the same time, if you're just looking at this movie, and I'm not looking beyond, there's still just so many things. I mean, the time travel thing is just a head scratcher. You're just sitting there wondering why. And it did seem like, oh, cool, we got Tom Hiddleston in his one quick shot. Okay, cool, we got this person in their one quick shot. Okay, we got this person in their one quick shot. I don't know. It was the first hour was really well done. And then it got into all the problems I have with all the other Avengers movies. And like I said, I understand that in 2019, this was really when it was like, okay, we need to make it so that the female superheroes and you know, just women in general in Hollywood deserved more credit. And we're finally starting to get it. But it always goes back to what I talk about a lot with Disney and a lot with the Marvel movies and a lot with the Disney movies in general. There's ways to do it naturally, and there's ways to force feed it down people's throats in hopes that like you're going to get the reaction. And I am sure that this got the reaction they wanted for a brief amount of time, but this is going to age like spoiled milk. I mean, it is one of those things that is so cringeworthy. It's so corny. It's so cheesy. It doesn't even make sense that all of the female superheroes are in that one moment. It doesn't even make sense that they're all together there. And it was just such fan service of Disney being like, look at us, we're allies. And it's like, there's other ways to do that in the movie without ramming it down our throats in such like a clunky way. And, you know, now that we're 4 years removed from that period of life, it just seems cheesy as hell. It really does. And you have to deal with Brie Larson's haircut during that part. And it's
which
just
is terrible.
What I'm looking at.
Yeah. But I mean, it's comic relevant. Like there's a reason behind it. Let's talk about this like woman aspect of it for a moment. That sounds really bad the way I phrased that. Let's talk about all these female characters here.
Try again.
Yeah, let's talk about all these female characters here and this scene, because it's really interesting. I groaned when I watched that scene earlier today. I was just I understand what Disney was doing at that point. Except your two most powerful characters in the entire MCU are women.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, and that's how you make powerful women in things. You don't have to highlight it. You just have the fact that Captain Marvel is literally so powerful that the Russos wrote her out of the movie until the end because she's such a big Deus Ex Machina because she's so powerful. And Scarlet Witch is, again, also incredibly powerful. In the comics, is one of the most powerful beings in existence, right? So you have these two incredibly strong characters, and then you're just highlighting the fact that they're women and not really letting it naturally breathe into their character.
Yeah. And it's the whole line of him saying, I don't know how you're going to do this, and then it's, she has help. And it's like,
yeah.
We have help. It's just
House. It's
oh
the
my
pose.
God.
It's that aspect of it where it's like Captain Marvel is such a threat that this entire armada tune their guns to her.
Yeah.
That's enough. Like that is enough to have this strong female character. She could have done the entire sequence by herself.
Yeah.
And it would have been totally fine. And then it's super impressive when Thanos is able to use the Power Stone and beat her off of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But again, it's just not tactful. It's not tactful is what it comes down to.
It's ultimately it comes down to the whole feeling of they're doing what the culture wants in that moment without thinking about how they are doing it.
Yeah.
You know, do it in a way that is going to be profound for generations or that is going to be exciting for generations. People are going to look at that in 5 years, 10 years from now and go, "What? Like, what are you talking about? That doesn't even make sense, because they're not going to be living directly in 2019. And that's something like I really noticed with the Marvel movies and with a lot of Disney movies in general, mm-hmm. Netflix movies a lot. There are always lines thrown in there that are straight out of whatever the media is talking about in that exact year. And it doesn't
mean the moment where do you mean the moment where the Hulk dabs?
Yes, there you go. That's another good one. Exactly. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense. Speaking of like controversy about identity in this movie, do you know this movie features the first openly gay character in an MCU film?
Yeah, which again also feels like it's why is that character in that one scene openly gay? It feels like Disney saying we need to have an openly gay character in our movie and we don't know how to write this into anything. That's what it feels like.
And do you know what the controversy around it was? It's played by one of the Russo brothers who's not gay.
So the Russo brother made himself the gay character so that they could get their, you know, I'm not using this phrase to be negative, but like their gay quota at the time of like, oh, we got to get our gay character to make themselves feel better about it. But he does it himself rather than actually getting a gay person to play the role and be like, hey, not only are we have a gay character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we have a gay actor playing the gay character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Yeah. Again, think about how you're doing it, not just what you're doing.
Exactly. And like, that's the issue with this. And it's just so, it's not thought through. And that's what I really dislike about this movie is they seem to think, oh man, we had to get through this as fast as possible. Could you imagine if this movie came out a year later?
I know.
Like, if this was slated for a year later, COVID's happened, it can't release. This probably keeps theaters going.
Yeah.
It's a wild concept to think about, but instead we get this hastily put together. It almost feels like three separate movies, like you said, right? Like, and the thing that really bugs me about this, I hate the way they bring Thanos back in this movie.
You mean like after he dies, the way he comes back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. I want the same character. We just watched the entire.
Here's my question. When they're determining where to time travel to, why not time travel to just after that moment? This way Thanos doesn't have his daughter being held hostage or whatever and like can see what they're doing. How about like just do it later so that he doesn't know?
Well, okay. It's kind of explained because they want to avoid interacting with their past selves. Although the way time travel is set up in this universe, it wouldn't matter if they interacted with their past selves. Because it creates a branched multiverse.
And that's a cop-out because they go to the moment in New York City where all of their selves are walking past them.
Yep. It doesn't make sense. Let's finally get into the time travel. Because the time travel is so annoying. I hate it so much. And I've mentioned it so many times on this podcast. I am so picky about the way time travel is explained in movies. First off, none of these people should be able to figure out time travel. Mm-hmm. We've seen nothing in the previous movies to even insinuate any of them could grasp time travel and be able to come up with a way to do it. Mm-hmm. Let alone like Tony Stark, a weapons manufacturer, can now all of a sudden create a time machine. Mm-hmm. That's just convenience. That's plot convenience at that point. You then establish the rules that going back in time doesn't affect the future at all, mm-hmm. which therefore means you're dealing with a branched timeline, which we do see in the future of the MCU, where we really get into like branched timelines, branched multiverses, everything like that. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, how does Captain America come back at the end of this movie?
Yeah, I know. I didn't even try.
It's not possible. Also, how does Thanos get there in the first place? Because it's clearly established in this movie, you need Pym particles to travel through the quantum realm in order to time travel. Theoretically, Nebula, like the bad Nebula, had to use the only Pym particles they had to get there in the first place. Yet somehow she's able to just like pull someone back without them. It doesn't make sense. None of it makes sense.
I'm getting a concussion listening to you talk about this.
Yeah, that's fair. But it's, like, it's so frustrating. It's so frustrating because it's not hard to keep time travel continuity going.
Mm-hmm. And that Jonas Kinsey says, agreed, their random knowledge of time travel is so hilariously convenient. It is. And it's the fact that it's hilariously convenient, but it's also looped into the fact of they're not even following the rules they establish. If it was convenient, okay, it's hilariously convenient, but you're watching this movie, right? Like you've seen other movies that are like, just go with it. Don't think about it. It's a movie. Don't worry about it. But it's the fact that they are actually trying to make this a clearer thing. And Raptor says time travel meet screenwriters. Like it would have been nice if they would have met screenwriters. So I don't know, man. I think the whole thing is super, super frustrating. And I agree with you. And, you know, when audiences went and saw this movie, they would just went with the ride because they were so into it. Yep. But I will say that since COVID, audiences have gotten a lot smarter and a lot more caring about how they're spending their money and spending their time when they go to a movie theater. And I think that if this movie had come out after COVID, I don't think it would have done as well. It has a 3.9 or something like that on Letterboxd, which I thought was crazy. Yeah, it made a bunch of money. It had really good reviews. I don't think that would be the case if it came out post COVID, because I think people would have said, why would I spend? Look at what Tenet did. Nobody ever talked shit about a Christopher Nolan movie. People act like The Prestige is the greatest thing ever made, and it's the biggest plot hole of a movie ever made. But people love Christopher Nolan, so they're going to say that movie is great no matter what. And then Tenet comes out, and everybody says, this movie sucks. I mean, it's very hard to find a person who will say something good about Tenet, and that's fine. If you do like Tenet, I would love to sit down with you and understand why, because I didn't get the movie, and I thought it was boring. But I think that this movie would have suffered that, because look at the movies that came out after COVID. Mm-hmm. Have any of them been well-received? I think there was one Spider-Man one, right? That was it.
There was one Spider-Man one. But when we get to that, it'll be very clear why it was well-received.
Yeah. Because what was the first Marvel Phase 4?
COVID was Black Widow.
So Black Widow. And that wasn't that well-received. That was like the beginning of the end. Shang-Chi kind of got like those meh ratings. Eternals was hated. Spider-Man, people really liked. And then Doctor Strange, Thor, and nobody liked those two movies. And then it was Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, which got good reviews again. But it's just interesting to see how post-COVID people weren't sitting there going, oh man, I'm just so happy. I got like audiences woke up a little bit because they had a lot more time to consume a lot more and say, you know what? I actually am getting bored with this.
Yeah. I think we're just at that point where people are more hypercritical of this. And it's interesting because I think we went through a stretch post-COVID where we had a lot of really good films mixed with a lot of really like not great films, but we didn't have a lot of middling films. And I was actually talking to a friend earlier today how 2023 kind of feels like a point where we finally get back to having a lot of middling films.
Yeah.
And it's showing progress. It's showing like things returning to their natural order again, which is weird, but this movie, it capped off an age, and then because we had this world-altering event afterwards, it really does feel like it's the end of an era.
Yeah, it does. All right, I'm going to jump over to this comment from Jason Obermeyer. He says, so what's your guys' favorite and least favorite characters of all sides, plus useless characters? Let's give like our top three characters from this and try to go with just the movies we've watched, John. Try not to go into the future in case. I know, and same with least favorite. Favorite and least favorite.
Okay. You know what? Prior to watching this movie again, I would have said Thor. I hate Thor's depiction in this movie. Like, straight up, this is a disgusting representation of someone going through post-traumatic stress and solving it with alcoholism and using it as the comedic part of this film.
Yeah.
It's not acceptable. Like, it wasn't acceptable when this movie came out. It wasn't acceptable, like, decades before this movie came out. And I know a lot of people talk about Fat Thor. Obviously, there's, like, the references to the dude and everything like that. Mm-hmm. This is just not okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. Like, I think it's, again, what are they saying and how are they saying it? Yeah. I think they're saying it in such a stupid way. I think there is a way to make this character totally fine, but yeah. they don't do it in this movie. Like they just don't they do don't. It in this movie. They lean so hard. They don't, you know what the problem is? Here's the problem. You can do this character and you can have it be, I'm really sad because this happened and now I'm going to be, you know, drink and get fat and whatever.
Yeah.
The problem is they don't give him an emotional beat that brings him back.
No.
They have that moment with his mom where it almost feels like he's going to get there, but it doesn't. They need the emotional beat where he gets real for a second and it doesn't happen because they didn't want to, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. So where are you?
Back to the question.
You didn't answer.
I know. I was actually just gerrymandering so I could figure out my answers. Best characters, Ant-Man, like Paul Rudd, Scott Lang is so good. It's so, he's just entertaining. And that's what it comes down to. I am going to give it to Peter Parker. I what Tom Holland brings to this role is just really, really strong. And who's this? Who would I say my third fan? See, I'm also like, I'm trying to keep it to the character, like what we've seen of characters so far. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of all these characters that I like at this point that get ruined in the future. I'm going to give it to, you know what, I'm going to give it to Bucky. I'll give it to Bucky.
There you go. Okay. I would go Captain America for sure. He's my favorite. There's no doubt. Drax. I love Drax. Oh, even in this one, he doesn't really do anything in this one, but I still like him the most. And then honestly, I'd probably go Killmonger. I think they butchered the character and could have made him better. And everybody knows how I feel about Black Panther. I don't like Black Panther, but I think Killmonger is the most interesting villain in the MCU by a mile. And they just underused the hell out of him. And Michael B. Jordan did a great job. Although when I do see Paul Rudd on screen, it makes me smile. So he'd be right up there. But I think I'd give it to Killmonger. And Andrew Denson said, I understood the people laughing at that fat Thor. But like, I just remember sitting there saying, damn, this man has been through some shit.
Yeah, he has.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I like that response to the character after he kills Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And like that immediate realization that Chris Hemsworth brings to the character of, I did this, it was probably not the right thing to do. And we see that trauma manifesting. I just don't like the fact that it's played off for laughs.
Yeah, I agree. And it needed a dramatic beat. And then that would have made the laughs okay, but there was no dramatic beat.
Yeah. And again, it also felt like a reason to bring in these characters from a previous movie so they can have their one scene on camera.
Yeah. All right, who's your least favorites? Three.
My least favorites. I'm going to go with Mickey Rourke's Whiplash from Iron Man 2.
Okay.
Just like a rehash of a character again with no real motivations of his own. Uh-huh. Motivation. Who was I saying the other day didn't have motivation? A couple weeks ago, I said this about someone, so it had to be someone recent. I'm trying to think of the movies that we watched recently in order.
I can give my three while you try to
think. Yeah, please do.
Okay. So my three, and this is not a result of the actors. This is a result of the way they were written. So when I use the actor's name, it's because I can't think of the other people's names and I don't feel like going back and looking it up. Number one, Christopher Eccleston's villain in Thor the Dark World.
Yes.
Absolutely atrocious. And Christopher Eccleston, I think, is one of the most underrated actors of all time. And yet that character is just god-awful, terrible. Captain Marvel, 1,000%. I hate Brie Larson's portrayal of it. I think that character is just so forced down our throats. I get she's cool, whatever. She's like all powerful, whatever. But it doesn't even mesh. If you watch Captain Marvel and then this one back to back, her character doesn't even mesh. It's
because she actually has a character in this movie.
Yeah, and there's none in the other one. So that really annoys me. And then what was the other one? Oh, Daniel Kaluuya's character in Black Panther. Daniel Kaluuya's character in Black Panther makes no sense. Daniel Kaluuya is one of the best actors we have alive right now. And they took him and they gave him a character that just his logic is zero. And you cannot have me feel for a character whose logic is zero. So those would be my bottom three. And a lot of that is probably because of expectations. There's probably other characters who are worse, but those I had such high expectations for that it bothered me that they weren't better.
I'm going to throw, okay, I'm going to throw in a couple that I feel just were so underutilized they become my least favorite characters. Andy Serkis's Claw doesn't make any sense how he's utilized in either of the two films he's in. And again, like, Andy Serkis is a brilliant actor. We know that. And he just does nothing in these movies. Mm-hmm. And the other one who I totally remembered and then forgot, because you reminded me when you said Christopher Eccleston, because obviously that was another waste of a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
Romwell, who we see in this movie, who is built up as this like Captain America villain, has like the elevator scene, like a bit of a villain arc in, I mean, obviously a clear villain arc in Winter Soldier, but then comes back in Civil War as Crossbones and like is there just at the beginning and has nothing to do with the plot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to pull from, really, for both sides. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad we did that. Now people can listen. Mm-hmm. If you listen until an hour and 5 minutes in, you get to hear our top three and bottom three characters as we head into, as we finish up what a lot of people would consider the end of the MCU. I think we have 11 movies left. So 11, and then by the time we're done, I think it'll be up to 12. So I think we'll have 11 or 12 that we still have left in this series. So about 3 months, pretty much get through the end of March, and then we'll start looking at what are we doing next, which we've already thought of and will be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But that's where we're at right now. Next week we are going to do Saltburn, which is now on Amazon. So we're going to do Saltburn. Mm-hmm. And we are going and moving on to Spider-Man Far From Home. That's what we're doing. Yep. Jason Obermeyer wants to know what will MCU's legacy be in decades. We'll talk about that when we get to the end. How do you think we'll be remembered, all of that? I think we'll start talking about, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit after we get through next week's, because that will be the end of phase three. But I do think that one way to say it right now is just oversaturated. You know, it's kind of like how back in the day people really used to love, you know, I mean, I guess this isn't totally fair, but it's like how people used to love CSI and then they just made every version of CSI and now nobody watches CSI. Kind of feels like Avengers. People will watch this stuff. People will watch MCU, but that's it. And then Andrew Denson says his least favorite were the Dark Elves in general. Great idea. Most of the Kree/Skrull. I probably should have put that. And then he said, I don't know, the random blonde woman from the Avengers. I love those. Good answers.
I have a question before we close off the podcast today for you, because we're entering a weird phase of the MCU moving forward. We're entering the TV show phase. Mm-hmm. Now, you're never going to watch these TV shows, but they are going to be relevant to films we're discussing in the future. Do you want me to tell you now on the podcast what's relevant from this movie going into those, or do you want to wait until those plots become relevant in a future movie we're talking about?
See, I think what I need to do is I need to just watch the movies as if I was a 30-year-old man who was going to watch these movies and wasn't going to watch the shows and didn't know that the shows were relevant. And that's it. And if it doesn't work, that's Marvel's fault. That's Disney's fault. So I think that's good.
So I'll mention them in the future when they become relevant to a plot that we are going to. But I'm going to spoil two now, because they have yet to pay off in any movie that has come out.
Okay.
The first one, the Loki we see in this movie is the Loki that the series is based off of.
Okay.
Not the heroic Loki we see at the end of Thor Ragnarok or the beginning of Infinity War. Not the person who's like the character that's grown. That series is based off of Loki as soon as the invasion of New York was over, but is treated like the character from the end of Thor Ragnarok.
Okay.
One of the worst characterizations I've seen in the MCU, in my opinion. Which is a shame, because Tom Hiddleston's great, but it makes no sense when you think about it logically, even when they do try to like explain it. Doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. The other one, and this is a big spoiler, so anyone who hasn't watched Secret Invasion yet, please tune out for like 2 minutes while I say this.
Or just leave.
Because this is... Or that, I guess. Yeah. But this has been a recent development that's just been announced. We have found out in the last couple of months Rhodey is a Skrull at this point in the MCU.
Okay.
So think about that. Think about how much I hated watching this movie knowing that today.
Yeah. Think about how much that just that's just stupid. All right. Thanks, John. Thanks for ruining the podcast at the end. Become a patron. I guess I'll reveal the first half of the month of January, and then after that, you all can get it on your own. But so our first episode, which is going to release on Patreon on January 2nd and is going to release on YouTube. When is it going to release on YouTube? It's going to release on YouTube on January 9th, so a week later. So if you're a patron, you'll get access to it early. Is going to be Mean Girls, because the Mean Girls musical is coming out on January 12th. And then on January 9th, and Mean Girls is 20 years old, which really makes me sad. Then on January 9th, we are going to be releasing The Mummy from 1999, which is 25 years old. And then on January 16th, we will be doing The Terminator, which is 40 years old. So those will be our first three movies if you're a patron. Patreon.com/thespecialists. That is what we will be doing for the $5 Tuesdays. Those are our first three Tuesdays. And like I said, the Mean Girls one will be releasing on YouTube on January 9th. So if you're not quite sure that you want to get into that, you can always listen to our Mean Girls one on the 9th. And then if you become a patron after that, you'll have access to the first two episodes, knowing that the Terminator is on the horizon and a bunch of really fun movies. And these are movies, pretty much these are movies that I like or that I should like. So it's going to be a different conversation than what we're doing here. Yes. And you don't have to sit down and just watch a random Russian TV movie about a dog with a heart or whatever it is, because we are going to watch movies that are bigger. I would say bigger. Yeah, I would say what was their cultural impact is kind of what we're looking at with this series. So that's it. Thank you all so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed the new look. I really enjoyed the new look. It's so much more pleasant to look at. And then when John's talking and I'm dozing off, I can stare at the really nice bright red behind everything. But thank you all so much. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you had a good holiday. Happy New Year. John and I will actually be back, though, on Friday. And we're going to be doing our year in review for 2023. So if you've listened to our podcast in the past, that's where we talk about our favorite five movies from the year, our favorite five movies we watched for the first time. Worst movies, blah, blah, blah. We're going to get into all of it. So that'll be on Friday. So tune in then. We don't exactly know a time yet. It's probably going to be in the middle of the day, though, because I think John's off from work and I don't want to give up my Friday night. So thank you all so much and we'll see you on Friday. And I missed the end stream button, so that's going to take longer than usual.